Good morning. How one primary candidate defied the polls to fight off a Democratic socialist favorite.
It definitely was a case of Democrats having this internal discussion of how much do we want a young left-wing reformer and how much do we want someone more conventional in a competitive election.
A former Disney CEO and Jared Kushner's brother buy the Lakers. The Athletic tells us what it means. And nearly three decades after Tupac's death, are prosecutors finally on the verge of putting someone behind bars? It is Thursday, August 13th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. The momentum for the Democratic Party's left flank slowed in the early hours of Wednesday morning as moderate David Crowley eked out a surprise win in Wisconsin's gubernatorial primary. It was a stunning turnaround. Just over a month ago, the Milwaukee County executive dropped out of the race because he wasn't catching on with voters. But he was compelled later to rejoin and to stop a Democratic socialist from becoming the nominee. He addressed that remarkable comeback in his victory speech yesterday.
Today, I stand before the people of Wisconsin after we rose from the ashes. I stand before you filled with gratitude, with humility, and hope as I formally accept the Democratic nomination to be the next governor of the great state of Wisconsin.
With the support of the state's current Democratic governor, Crowley defeated the progressive Francesca Hong, a state representative whose rise in prominence and polling had surprised and concerned many leading Democrats in Wisconsin. Joining me to discuss the results is Benji Sarlin, a senior politics editor at Vox. Benji, thank you so much for being here.
Gideon, thanks for having me.
So, first off, what should we make of this comeback from Crowley in Wisconsin and the rest of the results in this gubernatorial primary?
This was a really fascinating race. It was a very unusual race. And I think it definitely showed that there are limits to how far Democratic primary voters at the moment are willing to go when in terms of entertaining what it means to have an electable candidate in a swing state. It's hard to discuss without talking about the results from very recently in Michigan's Senate race, which also ended up coming down to the wire between Abdul El Sayed, who was similar to Hong, was definitely a movement left candidate and defeated a more conventional candidate, a race that brought out a lot of divisions among national Democrats. This race was a little different. It flew under the radar until pretty much the last few weeks when Francesca Hong, who was a relatively obscure figure nationally till then, and even to some degree within the state, through a series of events, some of which involving her own campaign, some of which involving other campaigns, became the dominant front runner in this race.
And Benji, you were reporting at Vox, you and your colleagues, that there were even conversations kind of within the left about the viability of a candidate like Francesca Hong. What was the trepidation there? What were the conversations about?
Some of the concern, I think, was that she was perhaps a little too inexperienced, but also inexperienced, especially answering these questions that have been sort of tripwires for left-wing candidates in the past. Topics like defunding the police, abolishing prisons. In Hong's case, the big episode was being asked about a tweet she said in which she called to, quote, cancel Thanksgiving. You know, tough sell to voters. And her answers around these were often kind of elliptical, disjointed. And whatever they were seeing, a lot of the national progressive leaders who have been so important in endorsing candidates and putting on the map stayed away from her. Bernie Sanders pointedly did not endorse her. AOC, same thing, no endorsement. A lot of these other national leaders who are kind of validators for left-wing candidates just stayed out of it.
What does it feel like the story is of the primaries amongst Democrats, at least?
Well, there's been a few. I mean, some people have taken this to mean that Democrats don't care about electability right now. They want principle over politics. I don't think that's quite right. I think one aspect of this is that Democrats are willing to take a much broader view of what makes you electable, and that perhaps running on some of these issues that would have been seen as extremely risky in the past, especially on Israel, where public opinion has been trending in the left's direction, that you can be electable as long as you're an exciting candidate who shows you can connect with people. But the other half of that is that Democrats used to have a pretty solid record, especially in competitive states and swing state races, of falling behind Democratic leaders when they got behind a candidate and said, this is the most electable person. Republicans have a reputation for overriding their leaders, first in the Tea Party era, then in the MAGA era, and picking unelectable candidates who blow very winnable races. Democrats, they've mostly overperformed. They've mostly picked candidates pretty well. They've blown very few races because a candidate had some obvious deficiency or meltdown. But what changed is Joe Biden. The party establishment, fairly or not, really got tarred with 2024. And so there's also a lot of skepticism to the point people want to sometimes actively vote against who leaders are suggesting, almost on that basis. That is also making it harder for them to fend off some of these more kind of quote-unquote insurgent candidates.
Benji, thank you so much again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Gideon.
Nearly 30 years after Tupac Shakur was murdered in Las Vegas, prosecutors think they might finally secure a conviction, thanks primarily to the defendant's own public boasting of his alleged role.
So this case was cold for almost 3 decades.
That's Hannah Knowles, national correspondent for The Washington Post. She's been following the trial, which began jury selection this week.
But then in 2018, one of the men in the car involved in the drive-by shooting that killed Tupac Shakur started doing interviews. He was interviewed for a documentary where he talked about what exactly happened that night.
All the chicks was like, Tupac, Tupac. And he was like, hey, like a celebrity, like he was in a parade. He wouldn't even been out the window. We would have never seen him.
And he also publishes a memoir in 2019 where he talks about this in detail. And so police see this and they go, wow, this is really going to be our last chance to take a crack at this case.
The man in question is Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, a former leader of the Southside Compton Crips. Around the time of the shooting, the Crips were in a feud with Mob Piru, a gang connected to Shakur's record label. Both were in Vegas for a Mike Tyson fight, and afterwards, members of Mob Piru allegedly beat up one of Davis's nephews.
And that sets off this chain of events where Dwayne Davis and his group, they want to get back at Tupac Shakur and his people. They end up catching up with Tupac. They're both in cars. They kind of pull up to each other. And that's when the shots are fired.
Davis was sitting in the front seat of the car that fired on Shakur. And prosecutors say he orchestrated Shakur's death in retaliation for the attack on his nephew, even if he didn't personally fire the gun.
They're saying that he provided the weapon that was used because he actually talks in his book about putting the weapon in the back seat.
But Davis now says his tell-all memoir was partially a work of fiction, and he's pleading not guilty.
Which is sort of amazing because, as the judge noted when they made this argument, Dwayne Davis has described the book as the whole truth, the real truth. He talked it up as, oh, I'm finally telling my side of the story. And so now they're in this awkward position of having to argue that actually they fabricated some of this for entertainment purposes to sell books.
Shakur's death became the defining moment of the bloody rivalry between East Coast and West Coast rappers. And the events of that day have been pored over ever since. That makes this trial a potential blockbuster event, with a long line of potential witnesses, including former Death Row Records executive Suge Knight and Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo, who served at the Las Vegas Police Department at the time. If he is convicted, Davis could face life in prison. The NBA's most famous franchise has new owners yet again. Yesterday, ESPN reported that the majority owner of the Los Angeles Lakers would sell the team just 14 months after he agreed to purchase it.
In the immediacy of all of this, it was like, oh my God, did the Lakers just get sold again?
Dan Wyke is a senior writer with The Athletic. Mark Walter, a billionaire insurance magnate, inked the deal to sell the Lakers to former Disney CEO Bob Iger and Joshua Kushner, the younger brother of President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, for a record-breaking figure of $12.5 billion. Wyke said that beyond the initial shock, there were some indications that Walter was under a lot of external pressures.
I think in hindsight, when we look at this and you see the other reporting that's out there about Mark Walter and investigations from the federal government and loans and different things like that, it becomes less of a surprise.
Walter, who also owns the Los Angeles Dodgers, is the subject of a federal investigation probing whether his insurance companies were involved in fraud, something that he's denied. Bloomberg reports that Walter wants the cash from the sale to pay down loans tied to his insurers. It's quite a stunning turn, especially as many Lakers fans were hopeful that Walter could modernize the franchise after many years of single-family ownership, just as he did with the Dodgers.
They had the best analytics, the best executives, and the expectation among Laker fans was that the organization was going to have access to all of that brain power and more, right? That's who they were going to be now moving forwards.
Now, though, the reins will be handed over to Iger and Kushner. Iger transformed Disney's fortunes as CEO, a role that also saw him overseeing ESPN. He's also been a big presence on the LA Clippers sideline as a fan. Kushner already owns part of an NBA team, the Miami Heat.
These two guys are going to team up now, and they have one of the great brands in all pro sports at their disposal. I should say here, they were very interested in NBA expansion. They were very interested in bringing a franchise to Las Vegas. And I think when they realized that this franchise was available, that the Lakers, like, why start from ground zero?
Kushner's involvement is particularly noteworthy. He was at the center of FIFA president Gianni Infantino's recent attempt to sell shares of the World Cup to private investors.
Josh Kushner was trying to, in some ways, buy soccer by trying to buy part of FIFA, by trying to buy part of the World Cup as part of this privatization deal, and was met with predictable scorn. And as that deal dries up, here comes another opportunity, right? I would say pro sports, particularly the NBA, is not held in that same sort of regard. But you do wonder, could one have happened without the other? Hard to know, right?
The sale of the Lakers is subject to league approval before the deal can be finalized. Here are a few other stories we're following today. President Trump's press secretary, Karoline Leavitt, has said that she plans to quit her post. Trump said on social media that she would leave at the end of the month, but would remain an influential voice in the party, and that she had been one of the best press secretaries in the history of the office. Leavitt said that she was leaving to spend more time with her family after recently giving birth to her second child. Her relative longevity stands in contrast to Trump's first term, which went through four different press secretaries. In Colombia, crews are still searching the wreckage of collapsed buildings for survivors after a 7.4 magnitude earthquake struck earlier this week. The death toll has now risen to at least 254 people, and thousands still remain unaccounted for. One woman was recently found alive after being trapped under rubble for 36 hours. A crowd in the city of Pereira cheered after the 10-hour operation to free her was completed. And finally, a solar eclipse briefly plunged Europe into darkness yesterday as millions gathered together to watch the moon cover the sun. It was the first of its kind on the continent for decades, with huge crowds assembling to cloud-free skies. Much of Europe and parts of the U.S. and Canada witnessed a partial eclipse, but in Greenland, Iceland, and Spain, people were treated to a total solar eclipse, where it's safe to take off those protective glasses. Thousands of so-called eclipse chasers descended into the Spanish town of Burgos, one of the prime spots for viewing. Reporter Georgina Rannard was there for the BBC.
It was this huge glowing orb, really, and around the edges you could see flares coming out, and then on the very edge, this Bailey's bead, this kind of diamond ring effect. And around me, people started crying, singing. Someone was singing Alleluia. You feel all these goosebumps. And I have to say, I didn't quite expect it to be so emotional, but it really was.
It kicked off what some people are calling a golden age of eclipses. Over the next 2 years, there's going to be another three, including the so-called eclipse of the century next year, set to last around 6 minutes. For those chasers out there, Spain will be a good spot to catch that one as well. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Time reports on why the government has started taking UFO sightings seriously. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.